Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Take just a moment and contemplate your own astonishing brain. Now, if you're a regular Takeaway listener, your brain has recognized our introductory theme and maybe perceived the familiar auditory patterns of my voice. All the while, your brain has kept your lungs filling and your heart beating. And most likely, all this was happening while you were occupied with other tasks. Maybe driving a car, making a meal, or taking a walk. Faster and more powerful than a supercomputer with enough electricity to power a light bulb, our brains have more than 86 billion tiny neurons, all coordinated with one another by a vast web of electrical and chemical signals. But the intricacies of our minds also render them vulnerable. Microscopic molecules can disrupt our personalities, shift our perception of reality, and dramatically alter our ability to think and reason. Indeed, something as simple as the chemical element, mercury.
Mercury is a mesmerizing element. It flows like water at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, a trick no other metal in the periodic table can perform.
This is Dr. Sara Manning Peskin, Assistant Professor of Clinical Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania.
If you separate a bit of mercury from the rest, it feeds up in tantalizing mounds. With a nudge, it rolls along a flat surface like a drop of water. Gold and platinum are beautiful in static form, but mercury's mystique lies in its dynamism, in the way it makes people question the laws of physics.
Professor Peskin is reading here from her new book, A Molecule Away from Madness, The Hijacked Brain. And she's revealing here the almost ethereal properties of mercury, an element that is poisonous to humans. But it's not the beautiful or dangerous characteristics of the chemical element that occupy Peskin in this book. Instead, she's interested in our minds and the ways that tiny molecules can have enormous effects on our brains and on ourselves.
So molecules can be as small as water. So we think of water as H2O. That's actually the molecular description. It's two hydrogens and an oxygen. And then there are giant molecules like DNA, which is the biggest molecule in our body. And what the book talks about is molecules of all different sizes that can essentially take down our identities.
In the 19th century, mercury was an active ingredient in a commonly prescribed medicine called blue mass. And historical evidence points to the likelihood that in the years before becoming America's 16th president, Abraham Lincoln took blue mass to address symptoms of physical and emotional distress.
This is a theory that was devised by a well-known infectious disease doctor named Norbert Hirschhorn. And he uncovered that Lincoln sort of had some unusual behaviors before he became president. We think of him as this really easygoing, sort of thoughtful, measured guy and a controlled guy. But actually, before he became president, there are some cases of him being sort of flying off the handle. At one of the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates, he almost strangled someone on the podium. In the last trial that he worked on, he almost attacked the judge in the middle of the trial. And what Norbert Hirschhorn actually figured out is there's lots of evidence to suggest that Lincoln was using a medication called blue mass at the time. And the main ingredient in blue mass is actually mercury. And we know now that mercury can cause people to be extremely volatile.
Now, today, we understand the effects of mercury toxicity. Tremors, insomnia, memory loss, and dramatic behavioral and cognitive changes. Peskin writes that, quote, mercury convinces neurons to carry out a massive act of cellular suicide, tricking the nervous system into sabotaging itself. Albert Hirschhorn and his colleagues discovered a recipe for the pills Lincoln may have taken and learned they contained more than 30 times what we know now to be the safe limit of mercury. His work remains controversial because it's impossible to test tissue samples from the late president. But even the possibility that Hirschhorn's work raises is provocative.
So it raises this question of, you know, we think of Lincoln as being one of the greatest presidents in American history. Is it possible that his acumen was almost lost to a medication side effect?
This tenuous grasp on our own minds and personalities, the fragility of our very selves, is what I found most disruptive and sometimes upsetting in Professor Peskin's book. After all, doctors and parents used mercury thermometers when I was a kid. It wasn't until my adulthood I learned some of my favorite seafood was laden with mercury. So I tried to quell my own panic as I read. But I wanted to know if Professor Peskin wrote the book as a warning.
You could think of it as this scary thing of, oh my gosh, we're all so vulnerable. But a lot of what the book is about is how we've actually had these incredible advances in science, and most of these diseases are now preventable or curable.
Indeed, A Molecule Away from Madness is not written to terrify. Instead, it's a history of ideas, a celebration of discovery, and a reminder of our resilience, even in the midst of our vulnerability.
I think we often think of the brain as sort of this scientifically studied object and the mind as the more sort of personality-driven, identity-driven word. But the reality is it's all the same thing. There are these molecules, which you think of as brain-based and scientific, but really that's what makes up your personality. That's what defines who you are.
I think many of us would like to believe that our personalities, our identity, sort of the thing we think of as ourself, is relatively stable. And I also suppose we tend to like to believe that we have a significant control over how our minds manifest in the world.
Yeah, I think we all have this idea of, I'm an easygoing person. I'm an outgoing person. You know, one of the diseases I write about in the book is a story about a guy, Danny Goodman, who was an outgoing, extraordinarily successful entrepreneur who in his 50s started an online wine company that became a huge success. He brought his son on board in the company, and about 6 months later, his personality changed. He used to hug his son every morning. He stopped hugging his son. He used to be very sort of fastidious and responsive, and he wouldn't answer the phone. Started asking strange questions where they would show him, they showed him the financial statement for February, and he asked, where's the 29th and the 30th? Or he started peppering the listings online with exclamation points. He bought tons of the same DVD. So he'd buy 6 or 8 copies of the same DVD or eat tons of pizza. He became just very sort of disinhibited, a completely different person. And, all the people around him said, maybe it's back pain, maybe it's, depression. And eventually he gets to a neurologist who says, it's none of those things. This is a molecular problem. This is a mutation in your DNA that's causing these personality changes. So it's exactly that example of where we think that we're totally in control over who we are. Yeah, but in reality, we can be sort of overthrown. We can have different identities because of the effects of these small molecules.
Stories like Danny Goodman's are tragic and appalling because of their mysterious suddenness. Without warning, Danny's personality transformed into something so profoundly different. But Professor Peskin also recounts experiences where the drastic change of a person's mind is not unforeseen. Instead, it's long anticipated and dreaded.
Huntington's disease is a condition that causes changes both in the mind and in thinking and also in movements. It causes people to have what's called chorea, which is this sort of writhing, dance-like movement. Sort of if you can imagine what it would look like to have sort of a fluctuating electrical current going through your limbs. And then it causes people to have a dementia. They can also have a lot of sort of agitation. They can get into habits that they wouldn't have otherwise gotten into. And one of the stories I write about in the book is actually about the discovery of the gene that causes Huntington's disease. It's this remarkable story about an incredibly brilliant woman named Nancy Wexler. And she was a Harvard graduate and a Fulbright scholar. She planned to go to graduate school in psychology. She's about to start, and her dad calls and says, could you come home for my birthday? And she's very intuitive. She says, my dad's not the kind of guy who tells people to come home for an event like that. Something is up. And sure enough, she gets home. Her sisters come in town also. They sit down on the couch and in her dad's living room. And he says, your mom has Huntington's disease. And it's a genetic disease. And there's a 50% chance that you've each inherited the gene that causes it. And Wexler relatively quickly decides that she's going to try to find a cure. And the first step to find a cure is to find the gene that causes the disease. So she basically overthrows her entire career, her entire life plans, and instead she does her thesis, her graduate work on Huntington's disease. And she and her father start creating these workshops where they bring together scientists from different disciplines. And they have all these rules, like you can't have slides and, you know, only a certain number of people in the conference. Their goal really is to get people to think out of the box, to get people out of their comfort zones. And out of one of those workshops comes what turns out to be the solution. And it's through her work that they ended up finding the gene that causes Huntington's disease, and finding the mutation or finding the change in the gene that causes Huntington's disease. And from that, we now can test people for the gene that causes Huntington's disease. So people who have no symptoms can actually get tested, and we can figure out whether they're essentially going to develop the disease. Wexler herself actually never ended up taking the test. She basically decided that she had more to lose than to gain. And eventually she actually developed the syndrome and developed the disease. Her sister didn't.
It's the profoundly human stories like Nancy Wexler's that distinguish Peskin's approach to exploring the science of the mind. And I wondered about the ways that public perception of neurological disorders has changed over time. After all, many of the conditions that are now treatable are ailments for which people were, until very recently, institutionalized.
One of my favorite stories of the book is about a young woman who grew up in adverse circumstances and ended up excelling academically. She goes to this elite university, comes home after graduation in the summer of 2016. She starts binge watching The Walking Dead. And she wakes up one morning and she just seems to have difficulty with memory. She keeps asking her mom the same question over and over again. She starts stumbling. She gets a fever. She goes to the hospital. And in the middle of talking to the doctor, she basically becomes acutely psychotic. She throws the doctor on the ground, throws a nurse on the ground. They need 9 security officers to restrain her. And she starts calling people by names of characters from The Walking Dead. And it's actually a security guard who figures out, you must have known about The Walking Dead and figured out what was going on and put it together. She gets admitted to the hospital. No one can figure out what's going on. And her mom actually reads an article about this recently discovered disease that causes young women to become psychotic. And she eventually convinces these doctors to transfer her daughter to another hospital where they very promptly diagnose this disease. And it turns out it's an autoimmune disease that essentially acts like PCP. So it's sort of as if she was on a constant drip of PCP. But because it's an autoimmune disease, if you quiet down her immune system, if you get rid of the initial cause of it, she actually eventually was cured. And she's now back living in the community and back to her life. And that's a disease that was only discovered in the mid-2000s. So 20 years earlier, she would have ended up, you know, in an institution for the rest of her life. Part of the point of the book is to really argue that neurologically, we actually have been very successful in finding cures to diseases. It's just some of these big Goliaths like Alzheimer's disease that we haven't gotten there yet. But actually, in other conditions, we've been very, very successful.
That barely begins to describe how Alzheimer's disease has confounded medical experts and scientists for more than a century. Now, Alzheimer's was first diagnosed as a particular condition in the early 20th century, and since then, researchers have learned a great deal, but still made little progress towards a cure. Roughly 6.5 million Americans over the age of 65 are currently living with Alzheimer's, and that's a number projected to more than double by 2050. But the devastation wrought by the disease is something numbers can't quite capture. The gradual onset of memory loss, confusion, a change in personality and behavior. With Alzheimer's, you lose your loved one not just once, but over and over again. It is the long goodbye.
You're exactly right about this sort of ambiguous loss with Alzheimer's, and that's part of what makes it so hard to study. Because it changes so slowly, and you can imagine if you want to see if a drug is making a difference, if the disease itself progresses so slowly, it takes a long time to figure out if the disease is progressing differently than usual. But in terms of where are we now, we're very good at diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. We're much better than we were before. the original Alzheimer's, he met a 51-year-old woman who had memory loss, and he was surprised because she was so young. So he waited for her to pass away. He looked at her brain under a microscope, and he saw these two structures. One is called plaques. It sort of looks like a spot of spray paint. And the other is called tangles, and it looks sort of like pieces of spaghetti inside of neurons. We now know, years later, that the plaques are made of a protein called amyloid, and the tangles are made of a protein called tau. And that's what defines Alzheimer's disease. So when we give someone a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, what we're really saying is, if I took a piece of your brain out and I looked at it under a microscope, I think I would see amyloid and tau. We've now become very, very good at diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. And by and large, drug trials for the condition make you, in order to participate, you have to prove you have amyloid and potentially amyloid and tau protein buildup. And we can do that in people who are living with a relatively non-invasive test. They come in, we give them an injection of essentially a tag that sticks to amyloid or a tag that sticks to tau. They sit around for a little bit, the tag circulates in their brain, and then we take a picture of their brain and we can see, do they have elevated amyloid? Do they have elevated tau? And we can really specifically and very quickly essentially give a molecular diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Up until now, the bulk of Alzheimer's treatment trials have focused on amyloid. And the reason for that, there's multiple reasons, but amyloid tends to build up about 10 to 15 years before symptoms. So it's sort of thought to be one of the earliest changes. There are some gene mutations that cause unusual types of Alzheimer's disease, and those are all related to amyloid. So the general thought is, if we can get rid of amyloid, maybe, or if we can prevent amyloid from building up, maybe we can stop the disease. We've spent enormous amounts of money developing drugs that try to do that. And thus far, they haven't really worked. And then we came on this drug, aducanumab, which was made by a company called Biogen. But it was one of the more powerful drugs in terms of cleaning up amyloid. And there was a very, very controversial approval by the FDA. And then ultimately, Medicare decided they're not going to cover the medication. And ultimately, where we are is that we don't know if it works. But there will be another trial with that medication. And there's two other trials with other medications that work similarly that are very, very powerful, Alzheimer's cleansers or amyloid cleansers. And those are going to read out next year. And if those work, that will change the landscape of Alzheimer's disease. That will be the way that we treat the disease. If they don't work, the entire field, I think, will move away from the amyloid hypothesis. We're going to stop trying to cure Alzheimer's disease by getting rid of amyloid, and we're going to turn towards other ideas.
Now, you also care for patients with dementia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my day job. Exactly. So I'm in cognitive neurology. So most of what I do is seeing patients with Alzheimer's disease and also with more rare causes of dementia.
So talk to me about how this sort of scientific knowledge of your side gig of writing research impacts your work in terms of caring for patients. How do you approach whether talking with your patients or with their families about these central issues?
I think writing about these diseases completely changed the way that I talk to patients about it. It changes the way I talk to them about diagnoses. It makes me a lot more conscious of not using jargon. I think I had no idea till I wrote the book how many words we use that we learned in medical school but are not accessible to the people we're talking to. And then also, I try to give patients a little bit of history about their disease, because I think a lot of us, we get these diagnoses and we think that the diagnosis has always existed for time immemorial. And actually, it's helpful to know, someone discovered this disease at some point. There's been research, and this is what's happened. This is what we've learned over time, and this is where we're trying to go. And so sort of put it into context. And I think it also goes the other way, that very much my practice informs my writing, that dementia is not a broken arm. So it's a disease that happens in a social context, and it happens to couples and families and communities. And those relationships very much, that's what sustains me in terms of the practice. And that's what I think makes me more motivated to write about these things, is the human side and the fact that these diseases affect relationships and that they change how people interact with each other.
Let's pause. When we return, Professor Peskin offers some advice for keeping our brains healthy. It's The Takeaway.
Mm-hmm. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. We've been talking to Sara Manning Peskin, Assistant Professor of Clinical Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, about the mysterious and miraculous ways our minds work. She writes about it in her book, A Molecule Away from Madness, The Hijacked Brain. And after reading some of the stories in her book, it might be tempting to run out and buy up a year's supply of vitamins and supplements. I mean, at least it was for me. That human desire to control what we can't see or predict, whew, that is real.
For one thing, you don't have to do any of the supplements. By and large, you get what you need in your, you know, in your diet in the vast majority of cases.
So what can you do, if anything, to care for the health of your brain?
One is exercise, and the data behind exercise is extraordinary. Yeah, and this is repeated in study after study after study. Aerobic exercise seems to have most of the benefit. So like stretching and yoga doesn't seem to do it, but a brisk walk or a bike ride, running, swimming, all of that has an incredible effect in slowing down cognitive loss, both in people who just have normal aging and in people who have dementia. What we generally tell patients is something like 30 to 40 minutes a day, 3 to 4 days a week of something aerobic. And then social engagement. There's been studies back to the 80s. There was a study where they gave people points for each of their social connections. And the more connections you have, the slower people declined. And then the other piece is intellectual engagement. And there's nothing specific that, you know, that people should be doing. Essentially, what we tell people is if it's not TV, it's probably helpful. You know, whether it's, you know, reading a book, listening to a, you know, to a show, anything is useful. So just the idea is to be a sort of continuous learner. In neurology, those are really the particular things that are very good for slowing down cognitive loss.
Do we have a sense of the mechanism of why pretty much anything but TV, right? So our sort of social engagement and our intellectual engagement, learning new things, why that is helpful?
There's the use it or lose it idea with neurons. And so basically, you know, even if you're working, if you've done the same thing for 40 years and it's rote and it doesn't involve any actual intellectual sort of reasoning, that's probably less helpful than, you know, picking up a new hobby in the sense that when we spend most of our days not doing any thinking, those neurons that would help us do that, the connections sort of get lost.
If Peskin's advice doesn't give you some peace of mind, maybe this will. Our brains may be complex and mysterious, but the puzzle pieces are slowly and remarkably coming together.
We're better able to define these diseases molecularly than we've ever been before. So we've just made huge, huge strides, even though you could say, you know, from 50,000 feet, we haven't cured Alzheimer's disease. That's the holy grail. So that's true. But we've just made extraordinary strides in treating other diseases and in defining Alzheimer's disease.
Our thanks to Dr. Sara Manning Peskin, author of A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of the Hijacked Brain.